Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The German command, actually, to their credit, played with French psychology, and they understood that the French senior staff were clearly still nostalgic about World War I and had really clearly not learned the lessons of the First World War.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts, Matthew Galt and Jason Fields.
Hello and welcome to War College. I'm Jason Fields.
And I'm Matthew Galt.
In World War II, France fell so fast to the Germans, the U.S. thought a fifth column had to have had a hand in it. But what were the real reasons one of the world's superpowers collapsed in only a few months? Was the German army that good? Were the French, who had held off the Germans for 4 years in World War I, that bad? Here to discuss it with us is Mark Mazurofsky. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Can we start actually in a somewhat unusual place? Can we talk a little bit about the political situation in France before the war started? What was the government like? Was it a liberal democracy? What were the stresses?
There were some sort of worrisome developments in the several years that preceded the Second World War. France had been governed by a Popular Front, which was a coalition of leftist parties under Léon Blum. From 1936 to 1938, the Popular Front basically collapsed, and in came conservative regimes that essentially were tilting far more towards a conciliatory approach towards Germany while reemphasizing sort of a heady nationalistic, almost chauvinistic agenda, obviously anti-communist. But kind of bringing back the good old days of the French conservatism with their allies in the business community. So what you see is France pretty much divided and polarized, heavily so, and almost in a situation where it can't really claim to be a united country. And there are also forces in France that are pro-reconciliation or at least pro-accommodation with Nazi Germany. And there is also a powerful anti-fascist movement, which, of course, results from those forces that were allied with the Popular Front, but also some of the extreme French nationalists are also heavily anti-German. So essentially what you have is a very fractured country. France was going through a heavily pacifist phase, namely that I think perhaps as a result of the First World War, there was this general feeling that of the never again. In other words, let's not do this again, and let's basically just adopt a purely defensive posture and not seek to have an aggressive, powerful military. And so that also undercut the military sector. An alliance was given to this Maginot Line that was built in eastern France to ward off any kind of invasion from the east, namely from Germany. This was a sort of a 700-kilometer-long succession of bunkers and fortifications extending from the Ardennes forests all the way down to the southern edge of Alsace. And the idea behind that is that anybody who wanted to come through, namely the Germans, would meet with fierce resistance and be forced basically to go around the Ligne Maginot and therefore be fragmented. And of course, the French thought by producing that effect, they would be easier to ward off and defeat such an invasion. Well, the joke was on the French, after all, because of their heavy reliance on this line. And they didn't really see it coming when the Germans basically invaded in mid-10th, 1940. What you have is a very powerful pro-German lobby in France, a pacifist movement, a disgruntled left, which is not raising the flag of defeat. On the international scale, you've gone to the Munich Conference of September 1938, where we saw the appeasers in England and France essentially bow to Hitler and sacrifice Czechoslovakia as the next victim following Austria. And living with that, you sort of wonder whether anybody could actually hold out against Hitler and a rearmed Germany.
Can you tell us a little bit about the size of the French military at that point versus the German one?
Well, that's the part that's actually kind of fascinating, because the French had, at least potentially, a standing army of close to 5 million, while the Germans had a standing army of about 3.5 million. Now, the advantage on the German side was the fact that they had 10 armored divisions. These were the panzer units. And the French were not as well equipped on that side. They had mostly light mechanized infantry divisions. But because of this sort of reliance on a defensive strategy, they weren't really keen to essentially emphasize independent autonomous panzer, or at least the equivalent of panzer units, essentially having their own sort of operational orders to act together as a homogeneous group. But rather than instead, those units were basically fielded to support the infantry. So this is in sharp contrast with essentially what the Germans had developed as a strategy, which was basically to segregate the panzer units and to make them into an autonomous strike force. And that's kind of what we discovered as part of the Blitzkrieg strategy. Also, the Air Force was well developed on the German side, but equally on the French side. The problem on the French side, again, is that planes were not geared towards an aggressive stance. I mean, they were basically used for reconnaissance and defensive operations. So what you see essentially is that although one could think that there was an even spread between the two sides, on the German side there was much more of an offensive coherence and on the French and British side, you see more of a defensive strategy taking hold of the way that the order of battle is organized.
So why did the French fail to realize that Hitler might go through the Low Countries? You know, that happened in World War One, right?
Yeah, but in a certain sense, it's not that they were caught by surprise. They just felt that they could stop the German armies from coming in. I mean, of course they were not aware that Hitler would strike so deep and so wide and so aggressively, because, I mean, it starts with Norway, and then basically Hitler just sort of picks his way down gradually down the map. And when finally the attack takes place against the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, it's almost a simultaneous attack. The German Air Force plays a determining role, as we saw, you know, with the almost the leveling of Rotterdam. And Belgium was basically not to be offensive towards the Belgians, but it was a cakewalk. It's flat. And just like in World War One, it became the crucible for a terrible sort of conflict developing again. The only difference this time is that the Germans were a little bit smarter than the French, and the British, and essentially they understood that the French were stuck in their ways from the World War One, and would essentially adopt again this defensive strategy and basically fight it out in Belgium. So they essentially teased the French into meeting them in Belgium, and while the French basically took the bait, and together with the British, the armored units struck through the sort of the weak underbelly, if you want, of the French defensive lines, which is the Ardennes and the Meuse area, which basically lies east-southeast of the heartland of Belgium. And they were able to throw seven armored divisions through the Ardennes forest, which the French did not expect because they thought it was an actual defensive line, unclear as to what possessed them to think that a forest could basically hold off seven armored divisions, but that was the French position. And while the French and the British were mired in the Belgian muck, so to speak, they were basically encircled very quickly as a result of this sort of bifurcation strategy, or what Churchill called the sickle effect, that the Germans borrowed. And I think by May 22nd, the British and French were surrounded in some kind of loose pocket, and the only exit was Dunkirk, and we know what happened there. It was almost like child's play, and I think it was the German command, actually, to their credit, played with French psychology, and they understood that the French senior staff were clearly still nostalgic about World War One and had really clearly not learned the lessons of the First World.
France knew they were coming, right? The attack wasn't a complete surprise.
No, there was not a surprise. I think what surprised them was the violence of the offensive. And I think they were in denial for most of the time. One of the exceptions was Colonel de Gaulle, who understood what was going on. And he understood also the value of using armored units separately from infantry. And in fact, to his credit, he was able to ward off in a small pitched battle in northern France a German panzer unit, and but you know, that was just him. And you know, it's one thing to destroy 500 German tanks, but it's another thing to try to ward off the 3,000 others. So I guess what he basically was the one that had the vision, and also he wanted France to modernize its air force, but he basically ran into stone walls, and I guess the rest was history.
So does this mean that there were no more troops anywhere else in France, or was it just that they weren't in any position to put up any kind of resistance?
They were they were deployed, but most of them were deployed on the Eastern Front. And the number of units that were meeting up with the German offensive in Belgium were inadequate in terms of countering what was obviously an extremely well-organized attack. And again, I think the French high command's excessive reliance on a defensive line like the Maginot Line proved to be completely ineffective, and French troops were essentially quartered behind it. So by the time the Germans are attacking around the Maginot Line, as was expected, French troops are not equipped to basically hold them off. It was just a matter of training and of psychological expectations. The morale probably was not very high. Again, as I tried to describe to you earlier, the mood in France was not belligerent, was not bellicose, but instead was somewhat, I'm going to say there was depression, but it was there was no fighting spirit, if you want, and not of the kind that could basically meet head-on a formidable force like what the Germans were deploying. Now, had the French been better organized, and the British, and probably with more motivation, had their air force been a little bit more on the offensive side, and had they also been a little bit more clever about how they use their mechanized units, again, this is all strategy, they might have been able to stall the German advance. It doesn't mean that they would have been able to ultimately succeed, but they would have at least dealt a heavy psychological blow against Hitler. But, you know, this is all what if.
Who actually surrendered? Which government was it in France?
by the spring 1940, there's pretty much no government. The government essentially abandons Paris and flees to the south. There, the National Assembly, what was left of it, endorses Marshal Philippe Pétain as the next leader of France, the only one who can save them, the hero of Verdun, who's, you know, at least 80 years old, but he still had his wits about him. And, you know, he was a symbol of all that was good about France, quote unquote, a symbol of a sort of old France, nationalistic, slightly monarchic on the side. But, you know, he was also authoritarian and not one to be cajoled by democratic principles. So that particular government settles in Vichy. And on the 22nd of June, an armistice is signed between that new leadership and the German military. So what you have is the France is half occupied by German troops, and the agreement of the armistice is to allow the Pétain government to rule over the so-called free zone or unoccupied zone, but it does have access to the occupied zone and is able to establish an administrative presence in Paris. So that's the way that the checkerboard looks like in the third week of June. In the meantime, you had de Gaulle making his famous speech that France would never surrender, and he basically leaves for London and establishes a free French, and that's the official beginning, I guess, of the official French resistance.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Was there a reason why the Germans at that point didn't just steamroll over Vichy as well and just conquer all of France?
Well, I think I think opinions are divided on this one, but the general consensus is that France was the most important power in Western Europe at the time. And Hitler knew that he needed the assent and consent of the French to basically reinforce the Reich, have access to resources, and essentially complete and strengthen his hold over the European continent. And the only way to do this would be to have an ally on his flank, more like a vassal, and the one who would be willing to do his bidding in exchange for an illusion of freedom. And in that regard, it was probably a sensible thing to do. Why pit, you know, 40 million people against you if you didn't have to do that? So I think by that, in that sense, it was a calculation. There was no intention really of subjugating France, although I'm sure there was a plan to do so. But the reality on the ground was that France was defeated, and there was an expression of political willingness coming out of the political class of France to seek an accommodation with the Third Reich. Again, as I told you earlier, there was an undercurrent for at least a decade of pro-German sentiment, which is very strong in some sectors of the business community and of the political community, and even amongst the intellectual class of France, to establish closer relations with the former enemy. And that probably might have played a role. I mean, the German ambassador for the Reich in Paris is Otto Abetz, who played a critical role in Paris in the latter years, in the mid to late 30s, as a German agent of closer Franco-German ties. And he was so good at it that the French government expelled him because they thought he was plotting against against the security of the French nation. So, and he comes back and basically finds all of his old friends. So it all works, you know, for everybody, at least for those who chose to dally with the Germans. And you have in October 1940 the famous meeting between Pétain and Hitler at Montreuil, which signals officially the beginning of the collaboration period.
What happened to all those French soldiers, the ones that, you know, presumably weren't killed in combat?
Well, the official figure, at least the one that I was able to find, is 1.8 million. French soldiers were captured and eventually sent to Stalags in the Third Reich. So that's where they ended up. Well, they were treated as prisoners of war. And in fact, the Vichy government spends an extraordinary amount of energy trying to secure their release, or at least establish proper conditions for them in those camps. And I think there's a minister who's ministerial portfolio that's specifically designed for, you know, dealing with the prisoner of war issue. So it was, you know, it was a thorn in the Vichy side, and it was something that that occupied their minds, because they wanted these men to come back to France and contribute to the new France.
And they still were treated a lot better than the Soviets were.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the Soviets were shot. In fact, at least in Mannhausen, the Soviet prisoners were shot even before the Jews were dealt with. So it was extraordinary what happened to the Soviet prisoners in terms of ruthlessness.
Did the French actually play much of a role in the liberation of France in 1944-45?
Militarily, that is?
Militarily, did, you know, the resistance, La Résistance is very famous, but did they have any impact?
It's the old joke where everybody was in the resistance, so.
Right.
Well, you know, it's still a very contentious topic. There is the... become a myth, if you want, that the resistance was the embodiment of the soul of the French nation at war with the Germans. And of course, it was fratricidal, because in order to be in the resistance, you had to rise up against your countrymen. And, you know, it meant probably that you, much like in the American Civil War, that families were broken up, you had to fight against your former bosses, your former colleagues, your friends, and people that you knew in your village or in your town. So it's a traumatic episode. And there are a number of waves of French resistance operations and movements. And there are those that were referred to as the résistants de la première heure, in other words, those who had resisted from the very beginning, from the get-go. And unfortunately, many of those first resistants were dead by 1942. So what you have is a gradual realization that by 1942, the Vichy government is really not cut up in the way that the French thought, because, first of all, they're starving. The requisitioning is inhuman. There's mass starvation in a number of cities, particularly in the south of France. On a scale that had not been known in recent times. The betrayals are constant. Of course, the trauma of seeing the Jews being deported, interned, marginalized, harassed in the streets affects an increasing number of people. But, you know, the French are slow to wake up in that sense. And I guess if one wanted to draw a map of France somewhere around 1942, 1943, you would basically see that from village to village, you could either encounter pro-Germans, pro-Vichy, or anti-Germans and anti-Vichy, but you really had to know where to go. And in the same sense, that's what France looks like at the peak of the collaboration period. So 42-43, it is extremely divided. And what I'm suggesting to you is that the resistance, regardless, it depends how you define it, but I would define it simply acting in small, medium, and large ways against both against the occupier and against the Vichy government. Small acts could be as simple as giving a bicycle to refugees fleeing or to actual resistance fighters or feeding somebody in need, to the medium-sized acts, which were basically to deliver mail for the resistance or to act as a drop, to essentially the higher level, which is, equally full of risk, and take up arms, help in blowing up railroads and communication centers and perhaps even attacking German forces or wherever that was possible. So what you have is a gradual buildup of activity. And so I do argue in favor of the argument that the French did contribute in different ways. Whether you think or not they're significant, that's again for historians to decide. But there's enough evidence to show that there was a critical mass of individuals who were ready, basically, by 1944. But again, it was a slow process, and many people who rallied Vichy in the early years were disgruntled by 1942. And you have sort of the famous case of François Mitterrand, who was the poster child for Vichy in the early years, and eventually gets bitter and begins to work for the underground. So then you have the resistance of the dernière heure, those people who saw, oops, we have to, we better switch sides. I don't want to be too simplistic about this, but you have this in every war, in every occupation regime, where all of a sudden you decide, oh, you're going to save a couple people. You're going to hide some Jews, and at the end of the war, when the Germans are going to see, I was great, that was good. I made up for all those bad things that I probably did, or that you suspect that I did. But fundamentally, I'm a good guy. So you had a lot of that too. But that's human. And again, in terms of military contributions, yes, there were isolated instances of military prowess, of extraordinary sacrifice. Like the Vercors was one of the most extraordinary moments in the French resistance.
What was that?
Well, it was the Maquis du Vercors, which, in other words, the resistance units in this sort of heavily wooded area, I believe, in eastern France. And they held off an amazing number of German troops, but they were basically, almost all of them were massacred. And of course, the German troops were aided by French loyalists to the Vichy government. So it was another example that once you're ready to fight, you're ready to do it all the way. And that psychologically, that does go a long way. And you're talking about doing so after 3 long years of exploitation, persecution, and oppression. The temperature rises, and of course, you cannot expect everybody to take up arms, but resistance, as I indicated earlier, is manifests itself in all sorts of different ways, and they can be, when taken together, they can be very effective in terms of destroying or at least demoralizing the occupier, keeping it busy, distracted, and that's all they really have to do while the plans are being set afoot to liberate the country. So by the time D-Day comes, and also the invasion of the South by American forces, pretty much I think everybody's ready to do their bit. So whether they contributed significantly before, I'd say in isolated circumstances on different fronts, it was more intense than others. But once the Allied troops own French territory, then the game changes. And of course, we have the Paris insurrection the week before Paris is liberated.
And the city rose up against the Germans?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Against both the Germans and the collaborators. Yeah. And inevitably, what you have is reprisal. And that was kind of an ugly chapter, but it was one that unfortunately is part of every. A very response by people who are oppressed is that they will seek vengeance instantly. And justice is swift. Whether you call it justice or not, that's again, it depends on where you stand on these matters. But nobody really knows what the numbers are. There was no clear audit. Conservatives basically accused the resistance of, especially the leftist resistance, of executing as many as 10,000 people. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But there were a lot of accounts that were settled brutally in all across France. Some of those may have used the liberation of France as an excuse to settle petty disputes. It's inevitable, but that was what characterized the first month of liberation.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Mark, for taking us through this whole thing. Matt, did you want to ask something else?
No, I mean, I kept thinking of questions, and then he would immediately answer them.
Thank you.
Can't thank you enough for doing this for us.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's show. War College is me, Matthew Gault, and Jason Fields. You can follow us on Twitter at @war_college or on Facebook at facebook.com/warcollegepodcast. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, please leave a review. It helps other people find the show, and we just might read your comments on the air. See you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.